Times, and we'd like to open it up for questions to any of the speakers.
Hi, Dean Anselmo, Los Angeles. I have a question for the surgeons on the panel. So we struggle in a lot of our patients with large lymphatic malformations when we do debulking surgeries, and I know it's kind of a mixed bag, but post-op complications, seromas, wound infections, we put big drains in and we strip the drains. I tried a series of patients with actually just, based on some adult data, sprinkling talc in the wound to try to do a talcadesis of the wound. And it kind of worked, but didn't really. So I know there have been discussions about the use of sirolimus, perioperatively. What kind of strategies do you think we should be looking at? Because this is a challenge, and you have to do a lot of expectation management and discussions with the parent. And oftentimes, there's no other option. You have to debulk these massive LMs. What things should we be looking at? Should we be operating pre or post-sclero? Does it really depend on the anatomic region? Are there any other thoughts that you might have? Thanks.
All right, I guess I'll jump at that for a second. Dean, you mentioned one really important thing. One of the most crucial aspects of operating in vascular malformations is expectation management. It's very rare that you're going to make a patient look the way that their parents imagined they were going to come out. So that's really crucial. And conferring on them trust in you that they understand their infections, prolonged drainage, sometimes bleeding, wound problems, they need to know about that. And if you tell them all that and it doesn't happen, you're a hero. If it does, well, that's what I told you was going to happen. So this is not perfection surgery. I would say that the options of therapy, the choices and sequence of what modalities are to be used vary, of course, by child, but also by what's available at your center or in your region. And so in our place in Boston, lymphatic malformations with predominantly macrocystic components almost always get sclerosed by Ahmad and his team before we think about surgery, because unless it's incredibly massive or there's a lot of microcystic component, oftentimes you can avoid the need for debulking surgery at all. In my experience, I don't find that operating after sclerotherapy that's been properly done makes it more difficult than if I operate primarily. Of course, it's really fun to operate on macrocystic disease. Macrocystic lymphatic malformation is a fun operation. It's got walls. It doesn't respect boundaries, but you can identify what's lesion and what's not. It's fun to do. But I almost never do it anymore unless they're huge, because they can do it with a needle instead of me doing it with a knife and leaving a scar and risking nerve injury, et cetera. Sirolimus has totally changed the way that I manage lymphatic lesions as a surgeon, mostly with combined overgrowth syndromes where they have lymphedematous components, microcystic components. We often have these really complex bulky lesions on sirolimus. I was scared in my pants at first to operate on these patients, so we stopped, because it's immunosuppression. Who wants to operate an immunosuppressed patient? We all have lots of other areas of our lives we do that when we have to. So I would stop the drug, wait till they were cleared, and then operate, and then wait a long time so it doesn't impair wound healing or cause infection. I've totally changed my tune on that. I now prefer them to be on sirolimus for quite a while. Especially if you have tense, bulky, woody disease, it softens it up. It makes your debulking surgery much easier. It makes the skin much more elastic if you're doing large debulkings and you need to pull flaps over it. I think I don't have any data for the fact that I don't have data for any of this. It's all experiential. I think it may diminish drainage. And I don't even stop it for the time of surgery. I keep them on right through. The exception that I would say to that is if you're putting in hardware. So, for example, our scoliosis surgeon, who does a lot of these sort of closed spine fixations, if you're going to put in hardware, I think a little holiday for a few days of the drug is a good idea. I think Gresham might have a sort of different experience with this, though. So,
yeah, I'll just make a couple of comments. The I think it's a great question because if you're experienced in managing these, and I think that's really the key, if you are a surgeon who manages these, you see the issues that happen that arise afterwards, and that's why I think it's important to have people that are familiar with it and have a team that surrounds them that can actually augment what they do. Surgeons can also use many modalities in the operating room, including, like I do, laser, or you can actually do some of the sclerotherapy yourself. You've removed a large lesion, but you can add to it by doing a little bit of sclerotherapy at the same time with the bleomycin or other agents, and I find myself doing that. But the expectations of the family is crucial, and if you're familiar with the surgical management and you've done multiple patients, then you actually have a better sense of what to tell the families afterwards. I find that when young people jump in, it may be, oh, this is going to be easy to take out, but it's not. It's not as it's the that's the easy part. It's the management afterwards. That's really the key. But we do operate more probably frequently in Arkansas. We don't jump to medical and sclerotherapy for like lesions like macrocystal lymphatic malformations. But I think that's just again creating an understanding of the options and then the expectation afterwards. What's best in that center's hands. So,
Gresham, this is sort of a question indirectly for you to answer, partially answer this question, though, and that is, do you find that the age at which you operate on these patients has increased over time? And I think that's a big part of the expectation piece, is that sometimes you do a big operation on a very young infant and or a toddler, and you pat yourself on the back because they look great, you know, immediately post-op, but there's a lot of remodeling to this disease that occurs over time, and as we all experienced, sometimes over a period of years, they look like they did not too far before you operated.
I may have gone the other way. I try to get to them as early as possible now in order to get ahead of the condition. But the thing that I've added more than anything is this multimodal, multi-staged approach, especially with the lesions that are so infiltrative and integrated within the soft tissue around it, that you do one part at a time, you know, in order to get ahead of it, instead of one big, massive resection. If you can get away with staged resections, I think that's probably the ideal approach. And so maybe that's my answer to it now, so that I follow them over years as a staged management strategy instead of a big whack, so to speak, since there's surgeons in the room, I can say that. So, yeah.
Craig Durkay from Norfolk, Virginia. I wondered if the panel would comment on Posibinil OK-432. The group from Iowa had provided it to multiple centers over about 15 to 20 year time period, and as of September, the Japanese company Chugai is no longer providing it. I know there's a U.S. company, Altera, I think is the name of it, that wanted to pick up the mantle, but is your experience with it positive enough? Should we be considering it as an alternative to bleomycin and other sclerotherapy agents? Thank you.
Well, OK-432 is an excellent agent, but I don't think it has any significant advantages over the simpler available combinations of agents. For example, if you use doxycycline, cheap and easy to prepare and use, and safe, a bit painful to inject it. You can combine doxycycline with a small amount of bleomycin. It doesn't have actually to reach to the higher limit, and I think people use it excessively. The issue with the OK-432 has never been actually approved for clinical use outside research, as you know. So with the Japanese not interested in continuing with it, it made it even more difficult to get it. So in the past, people use it within the research. The research that started, I believe there are several institutions that were involved. But the outcome that was published is actually not superior or different than the outcome people got with doxycycline and bleomycin. It's an easier agent to use. You probably don't need to drain every single sac there. You can do it. Some people do it actually in the NICU, the child with the big, they go and just inject with a small syringe and put a couple of cc's and you're done. You don't have to put a drain and aspirate. And they claim that it does actually the job because it modulates something at the level of the immune system with other other things. But people get the same response also in the published literature from the current cheaper agents available. So I wasn't aware of the interest of the American company you mentioned. Is that, are they serious about it? Or because it's an easy agent to use also and it's cheap, similar to the available ones.
We weren't didn't have the opportunity to use it, unfortunately.
Other questions, or should we move ahead with some case presentations? Okay.
So I tried to pick a case that would involve all our panelists, number one. And number two, a case that is a common problem, but wide spectrum of presentation. And I have no relevant financial relationships to declare. So this is the fetal MRI following a fetal ultrasound of a woman who is presented to the Advanced Fetal Care Center, a very, very extensive lymphatic vascular malformation in this fetus who is about to be born within the next few weeks. And so I asked primarily the surgeons on my panel at this stage as to how they would prepare for this case. Gresham or Annie?
We may have different approaches, but I would say, it's difficult to say from single imaging, but you know, an assessment of the airway, and I would counsel the family that a normal delivery is possible. That you historically there was always an exit to ECMO concern. However, we know that if this is truly a lymphatic malformation, that it's very soft and compressible, that the baby should be able to be born vaginally. If you're concerned, then you can, of course, offer C-section with an ENT and pediatric surgeons as well as the interventionalists on standby. But that would be my initial sort of thought process.
I pretty much echo those sentiments. Sometimes I look for other factors like polyhydramnios and see if there's significant obstruction that's already emerging. We typically, in this scenario, because like she mentioned, it's compressible, we would either be prepared for a exit procedure or basically just a C-section. I would probably have a better sense of what the MRI looked like myself,
right.
A better view of the airway before I made that decision. But definitely challenging, definitely raises a lot of alarm, and I'd be prepared to intervene with the airway immediately.
Yeah, I mean, as in any of these cases, I apologize. I have to pick a few selected images. But the airway was very difficult to identify on all the MRI images. It was really, and that's primarily, just as you pointed out, we really try to look to see, can we determine where the airway is, what are our thought processes as to the possibility of intubating at birth, obviously, and the amount of polyhydramnios sometimes can be a little predictive of that as well. Steve, you were going to comment?
Yeah, I'll just add one caveat. I used to do exits for all these, and we've stopped. We found that these are compressible. They're usually less impressive at birth than they are in the imaging. You need to have somebody in the delivery room who can handle a newborn airway and intubate the patient. We haven't had any that weren't intubatable, but you have to be certain of the diagnosis. If this is a teratoma, you got a whole different situation in your hands, and then you've got to be doing an exit procedure.
Well, this baby was actually born, it was a number of years ago, was born by an exit procedure. At the initial laryngoscopy for the attempted intubation, it was with quite a bit of soft tissue and compression of the airway, but an immediate cyst decompression was performed in the OR, and the child was able to be oral tracheally intubated. And this is a picture of the child here. So now that this child's airway has been stabilized, there are a few additional MRI images to share with you. So a very, very primarily macrocystic but also some microcystic components here. I tried to pick a few selective images just as you would document where the airway is from the mouth layer to the trachea on these views. And then a few additional sagittal and coronal images as well. So at this point, with this lesion with the airway stabilized, thoughts, Dr. Alomari, at this point?
The difference between the pre- and postnatal MRI, they can be striking. I mean, you may start with something smaller, moderate size, and the patient's neck is, like, flexible. Then within the first couple of weeks of life or a couple of months, it may turn into this complex thing. You see how many septations there, different colors, different. Some of them have blood, some of them have thicker lymph, and the head is tilted that way. So they can progress early in life to a more advanced stage. That's just nothing changing actually inside the malformation itself, except you're just retaining more fluid. But they can retain even more if they're irritated or with any small viral infection. The deceptive thing that I typically see people doing, they will start this sclerotherapy and then they will target every single one of these cysts. And they do a good job with it. The truth is that the leftover is the more complex, thicker, microcystic, and the stuff that you cannot aspirate. That tend to be the rate limiting factor, the rate of your success. It will limit how much you can do. And from my experience, those you can chase all these cysts over weeks and weeks, and then they will bleed into another cyst and they will swell there. Then you drain it, and then after seeing the results of the medical therapy with sirolimus, and Dr. Adams can comment on this, I actually stopped just chasing those as the last hope for this child. Actually, we're improving the bigger ones. You underestimate, when you see the bigger cysts, you tend to underestimate the microcystic disease. Once you have a combined one like this, it's often the microcystic disease that will be the component that will stay with the child and challenge them later. And this is why I would recommend consulting Dr. Adams early in life.
I think this is a perfect example of a patient that's suitable for sirolimus. Now, again, we do it as a team, right? So if our team got together and felt that some sclerotherapy was necessary, then we would do the sclerotherapy, but at the same time would be talking to the parents about sirolimus. I think people get nervous about using sirolimus because it is an immunosuppressive agent in the young age. For our study, there were at least half of our patients were in the neonatal period that were on sirolimus. It needs to be done in the right manner. It needs to be done at a center that knows how to use sirolimus. You need to use PCP prophylaxis, but we have not had, even in the study, had anyone who had a significant infection, who died, who had PCP pneumonia. It was the people who were not prophylaxed for that. And we've had some tremendous results with sirolimus. There is dosing of sirolimus for neonates, so you know you have to be aware of that. Again, it should be a hem-onc physician that's managing the care of this patient, but I think sirolimus would be a good option.
Can I just make one comment? There's a massive tissue expansion component to this lesion, and it's hard to tell from this MRI, but it seems like mostly a macrocystic component. We try to do what we can surgically in order to kind of get as small as possible. I know this is controversial. I know we all sit at a table of people that probably treat this thing in a different way, but I do find that if I had sclerotherapy or sirolimus with patients that have come to me on those, that I do find that identifying those planes or letting the soft tissue that is normal that falls off of these lymphatic malformations is a little bit more complicated. So when I operate them primarily, debulk it, the other issue is that this child has an airway concern still. There's still a compressible component on this. Okay. And if you do sclerotherapy, you probably have some, you know, inflammatory component that's that compression. You may need to do a tracheotomy in that scenario. What I would like to do is, as an alternative to tracheotomy, is to remove and debulk the majority of the lesion. So if you get some inflammatory response that leads to worsening of the condition, then the airway is not compromised. So.
I think our experience, at least with the study, has shown that with sirolimus, for certain patients, I mean, and you'll know within, you know, like a two, it will take about a 2 to 3 month period of time, that you can actually get that area to shrink down. And at least the patients that I've taken care of, the surgeons have said that it's an easier surgical procedure when that happens. But again, the importance here of what you're hearing is studying and following outcomes, because and natural history, which is something that we need in this field.
Well, this little one was treated in almost all those respects. He did get some sclerotherapy. There was actually an unsuccessful, well, I don't think it was even a purposeful extubation trial, but it actually made it clear that his airway was at significant risk, so he did undergo a tracheostomy, a gastrostomy at that same operative setting. Some additional sclerotherapy was performed, and this is actually at the time of his tracheotomy. Despite the first sclerotherapy treatment, was treated with an additional treatment after the tracheotomy. And then over a short period of time, just as was mentioned, he was entered into that phase two trial that you had described, Denise, earlier. And he was treated for a full year of that trial, which I think is what your protocol was at first, correct? I think he was one of the patients in that trial study. And as you said, with his immunosuppression, these children also go on antibiotic prophylaxis, correct? Do you want to mention anything about the periodic monitoring of them over that period of time?
Well, I mean, so for this study and for it sort of is tiered, and it depends on what the level of the sirolimus is that you are targeting. So for the study, we targeted a high level, so it was a level between 10 and 13, and that is an immunosuppressive level. So, you know, they need to be seen at least monthly. They need to have monthly labs. The PCP, the PJP, that's the Bactrim, is PJP prophylaxis, so pneumocystis prophylaxis. So it's, you know, they're monitored very closely, so.
And this is this little guy at the beginning of that trial, and this was actually his images following that trial, which are very different than the original images that I shared with you, but still, almost as was said, his macrocystic disease has been replaced by a quite significant microcystic component. So the family elected to continue on the drug for an additional 6 months. It was ceased at about 19 months of age. And this was him at that point, post those treatments. So, still has his tracheotomy in place, yes. And these are his images now at that point. Sagittals. And some axials and coronals. So at this point, he's completed the treatment and options from the panel standpoint.
So I think medically, sirolimus isn't going to make this go away, right? So this is not one cell that's growing out of control like cancer. So I think, you know, you need to get to a certain point, and then you need to think together with your team on what the next steps are for this patient. So go ahead, team.
Right. Yes, we.
I mean, these are challenging cases, right?
Yeah. it is. Clearly, you have to examine the airway at the same time. Our goal for a patient like this is to get the trach out within the, if they come to us with a trach within that first year, which we see them. It's a combined multimodal approach that at this point does not include sirolimus, where we're doing a resection primarily of the largest portion of the disease. Removing the soft tissue expansion effect of the skin, the soft tissue that's been exposed. And then at times using intralesional to touch up that microcystic disease, bleomycin therapy, when they come back to see us. So it takes us every 3 months we do a little bit of, we do a big resection at first, examine the airway, treat the airway if we need to, followed by bleomycin therapy to kind of touch up the remaining disease.
Pretty much what happened in this regard, debulking excision at around 3 years of age. And as Steve mentioned earlier, He was put back on the sirolimus 2 months preoperatively, and that was continued for 1 month, 1 month postoperatively, and also had some additional sclerotherapy performed. So here he is after that, after those interventions. And this is his current imaging studies. Additional thoughts from the panel?
So I know what you're going to say. Mm-hmm. So this I think is where we need to be examining tissue, right? So I think we need to be looking and checking genotypes just to see if, you know, as we have other medicines that are out there in a trial, what are better for them, and then you can.
Yeah, I agree. This is continue to be a challenge. This is a child that's going to need repeated therapy over time, at which the intervals then get longer and longer in between therapeutic sessions. I didn't see if he had trachs, though. Is his trach still?
He still has his trach. Yeah. You know, with these multiple, with these procedures planned. Yeah. So, and just as you said, you know, I mean, there's no quick and easy bullet to these cases, and that just was really the point for presenting this to CASE, is that it challenges all of us. Makes us use all our talents from everyone on the panel. He has had a capped polysomnography study recently, and he actually did great on that study, and so we are working towards decannulating finally now as he's approaching his school years. Thanks. Thank you very much.
So this shows how challenging and humbling these patients can be. We have 8 minutes and 40 seconds left. I'm going to try and run through one more quick case. This is a patient with the CLOVE syndrome, has lots of predominantly lymphatic malformation, overgrowth. You can see the deformity of the feet, which is a classic, lots of bone anomaly as well. So lots of bulk hair. Anna, you showed a patient with some forms of this, and not as many parts, but some parts. Is this somebody you would approach surgically?
Ultimately, but I think Dr. Alomari mentioned, you know, do not pass go this patient before you consider any surgical procedure. You really need to study sort of head to toe to understand what's involved, what is their intra-abdominal, obviously the genitalia are involved, is there phlebectasia, because you would not want to proceed down an operative path without identification of any of these phlebectasias, because you really have to prevent thromboembolism. So that would be my first thought. Also laboratories, and then calling my interventional and you know, my oncology team to also consider early intervention with sirolimus, as I think that Dr. Adams has alluded to, there can be a lot of benefit from early initiation of drug therapy. This is, you know, obviously going to be a lifetime issue and not solved by any one of us alone.
She makes me very proud. So I would do exactly the same thing if this patient presented today. This patient was earlier than the sort of regular use of sirolimus. Ahmad, she's going to consult you. She doesn't want to operate until she excludes phlebectasia. What kind of study would you recommend before she feels safe to operate?
Well, we have been recommending, that's the only disease where we recommend MRI from head to toes, literally, because there are findings at every level here. And for the bigger things, like bigger veins, I think you can see them with, even if the MRI is encompassing the whole body. After that, you have to decide whether these veins are significant or not significant. And there are no cutoff limits to what is significant. But if you just gauge them by the veins next to them, if they're bigger than the femoral vein, which is an easy vein to see, then I would say it's a bit big and it shouldn't. But the MRI also underestimates the size of the veins. So if you see an anomalous vein, just let someone treat it before, especially the part that goes up in the thigh, into the pelvis, into the internal iliac veins. These are the veins that tend to be typically not very known to people. They report sciatic vein in these patients as a report or case report. Well, it's actually the exception that they don't have it, especially right. Clipple patients.
Okay, so this patient would get the full body evaluation for ectatic veins, would get treated. I agree with Dan. I wouldn't touch this patient with a scalpel until I knew that there were no veins that were going to cause the patient to die from a pulmonary embolus. And for those who've never seen it, I promise you that it happens. Don't ask me how I know. So here we did approach this in staged surgical debulking. We did the biggest part first, so we did sort of the torso. This is not rocket science surgery. As Annie had shown, lift up the skin, take out the Christmas present, and get rid of the extra wrapping paper, and close it back down. You have to sort of be a little creative about what you do with the skin. You want to save the better parts of the skin, get rid of the worst parts of the skin that have all the vesicles in it, and put it back together in the best fashion that you can. Then the next stage, we went ahead and did the genitalia. You can see this here, and a similar idea. It's every one of these is a make it up as you go along, individual operation. So then we went ahead and did the buttock and thigh region, exact same principles. Open up the wrapping, take out the package. You got extra wrapping paper, put it down, cut off the extra, and do the best you can. I don't mean to trivialize this. These operations can be bloody operations. You have to have an anesthesia team who is comfortable with what you're doing here. I take pictures after the bleeding has stopped with new, fresh blue towels. These are non-trivial undertakings, but can be done. So, all right, we've done all the sort of grossly externally visible stuff, and now we've got this chest X-ray that shows a not uncommon lesion with Clove syndrome, where they'll have a paraspinal mediastinal component to this. So we now have got this child, and you know, there's this mass there, and she's fine from a respiratory standpoint. Would you operate this at this point, Annie?
And I'd call up Dr. Adams and ask for some drugs first.
We don't have sirolimus yet.
No.
She's not symptomatic.
Not symptomatic. Probably not.
So you'd watch it?
I'd just watchful waiting for a while.
Yeah, that's what we did. How about now?
Yeah, it looks quite large, so
right.
Your so hand might be forced.
Yeah, so now we're at the stage where you've got a problem with lung development, chest wall development. This is a 3-year-old child who's got a real problem, and these do grow. So I will tell you that I scheduled this child for thoracotomy to take this out, and the day before the operation, I met with the mom, and I chickened out. And I reminded her that when I did the first operation on the thorax, that the really big one, that was a particularly bloody lesion, and the drain, I don't have this happen very often, it wasn't just serous sanguinous fluid, but she had pretty bloody stuff coming out for months. Required, that's why she had a porticat, she had transfusions, we ended up having to do some, we don't have to go into the timing, but we ended up wrapping her with a vac sponge and injecting fiber and glue and all sorts of weird stuff. We actually got that out, but I told her that, you know, we got her through those weeks and months because it's a closed space between the chest wall and the skin with the drain in, and if we get into that kind of bleeding, the mediastinum, she's going to die on the operating table. And she said, I can't let that happen. I said, well, I can't either. We both sort of cried in the office. And I said, you know, I'm really sorry. I don't know what to say. I just wish I had a pill to make this go away. And I said, wait a minute. Now, this was in the early days of sirolimus. And so I canceled the operation. I said, I'm going to introduce you to some friends of mine. And we had long conversations. And we did, in fact, you wouldn't hesitate in this day and age to give this patient sirolimus for a second, right?
No, I mean, I would have hopefully take that tissue that you have, and we're very fortunate.
We have tens of pounds of tissue that we can test.
We're very fortunate that we have a, so because of an oncologist, we have something called Oncopanel, and it's a panel, and PIK3CA is on it, and some of the other RASopathies are on it. So just, you know, in preparation to, you know, this is definitely a cloves. This is a PIK3CA phenotype. So the drug we have is sirolimus, so I wouldn't hesitate. But I would also, in today's day and age, really think about genotyping this patient.
So we went ahead and treated this patient, and you can see the sequential imaging in less than a year. So if you don't believe that a medicine can shrink a malformative growth, here is the proof. And here's before and after chest x-ray, if you like old-fashioned imaging. And I was the most grateful surgeon to not have to operate on this patient. And now she's years later and is doing beautifully. We have 8 seconds left. We'd like to finish on time, but if anybody has any questions or comments, the panel will be happy to stay afterwards and take them. Thank you all for your interest and attention.